stand with us. Before we have our panel come up and I introduce Clark Scepter, who's going to be moderating it, I just want to give you a chance to say thank you to this music team that's led us this weekend. Some of the and this next group of people are probably not in the room because they're busy running around doing other things, but people have organized this. Nellie Sinnell. Nellie, are you in here? See, I'm calling her out for not being in the meeting. But there's been a number of people, Nellie, Christine Osborne, so many people, Patty Nicholson, Julie Sept, others who have really worked very hard behind the scenes. And if you get a chance to see any of these folks, please express your appreciation. But just in case they might be in the room here, let's thank them, our sound engineers, and everybody else who's helped put this conference on. That, of course, would include Amy Reynolds and her crew and all those folks that have been serving us food throughout the weekend. Well, this has been a great afternoon. I've really enjoyed the two seminars I had a chance to go to. Continue to be challenged and to grow in my own thinking about consumption and justice. And right now we're going to invite our speakers to come up. Dr. John Perkins is going to be joining them as well. And this session is going to be about your questions that you've been asking. I have a conversation with our speakers. Clark Sept is going to be moderating our discussion. His main claim to fame is that he's married to Julie Sept. But he was one of the co-chairs of our mission study team that spent the first year of our transition time preparing for our pastor nominating committee to do their work. So he is deeply invested in the life of our church. And we're grateful for his leadership. So, Clark, thanks for moderating this conversation. And he's going to take the questions that many of you have written and have a conversation discussion with our panelists.
Thank you, Tim, for the introduction and for kicking off this question and answer time, I want to thank the people who have submitted questions. It sometimes takes a bit of prompting, and some people it only took a little bit of prompting, and there were a lot of questions that came through. We will work diligently to get through as many of the questions as possible. What I wanted to start with, however, was introducing the notion of dialogue. Dialogue is at the heart of community, and we, as we gather here, are in community. And so I've asked each of our speakers to take a moment, a brief moment, to say just a word about what their experience is now that they're here, having had the chance to listen to one another and in some of the conversations with those of the rest of us gathered here, just a brief reflection, and then to pose a question that is important that the others might be able to weigh in on. And so we'll take 15, 20 minutes of this initial dialogue, and then I will read through the various questions that have been submitted, and we'll go from there. And I have the unenviable task of cutting people off mid-sentence. Hopefully not, but Dr. Perkins especially has given me full permission to shut him down if he starts going on too long, and I have said I will be gracious but firm. And he's capable of doing that. So perhaps just as a start, Dr. Perkins, perhaps just a couple words about you're here and your initial thoughts, and then a question really to the assembled group, but perhaps that the other three can respond to.
I think that if there is a contribution that I have made to this emerging new church has been the 50 years of trying to integrate faith and justice back into the community. And I sense that it's happening. Hmm. I sense that there's a new people, almost a pulse, small percentage, racial group. Religion, Judaism, and Christianity was never meant to be a race. It was meant to be a people. It was meant to be a call out people from all the races to bear his name. And that would be an ongoing miracle within itself. And we are racialized grace in our society. But there's coming up a global people who are seeing through our own bigotry and racism that had a better sense of justice. And I'm just so glad. And I sense that in this group. I'm sensing it. I see some improvements that could be made, but there's always improvement. Because we haven't really broke through now that what so-called black church, which is a misnomer. Mm. We talk now about a call out people to bear God's name in the society. And I'm seeing that begin to happen, and I'm glad of it.
Great. And so perhaps to turn that as a question to the other three of you for a brief reflective comment, are you seeing a similar breaking in the communities where you live that gives you the kind of hope that that he has just spoken about? Antonio, perhaps you?
Well, in Brazil, of course, we face some different issues, and I believe our society was more integrated than here from the beginning because of the Portuguese guys. They were different from the Anglo guys who came over here, and they were more, eager to get in touch with the Indians and then the slaves in Brazil. And so our society is more mixed than here. In one sense, I'm not saying we don't have that problem so much, but the problem that we have in Brazil is more social and economic than race. And just as an illustration, in Brazil we don't have the concept of African American, Japanese American, or Chinese American, whatever. Mm-hmm. In Brazil, everybody's Brazilian. We never ask, are you a Japanese Brazilian? Because it's a Brazilian. It's in Brazil, it's a Brazilian. And No, it's very simple, but that's the way we operate. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so it's not so much race. You go to a favela or to a shantytown, and you see more white people actually in the favelas than black people. And people don't realize that, but that's true. So it's not so much race. Of course, we have some, but not so much as here, where you sense something like that. But it's more economic and social.
Mm-hmm. Kim?
Yeah, I think the Singapore context is similar to Brazil. So we're Christians, but the church is largely middle class. I've talked about the migrant workers, and they tend to have their own service. They're there, we welcome them, but you know, you meet at 5 o'clock on a Sunday. And there are other practical reasons, but yeah, it's the same thing that we haven't really, the challenge is for us to be a called people, mm-hmm. but on different lines.
Colin?
Christianity has been in India for almost 2,000 years, from 37 AD. That's when St. Thomas came to India first. So it has been integrated into India as almost a subcaste and accepted in many parts of the country. But at the same time, it is also emerging in many ways and growing. And there are a lot of challenges. There are a lot of divisions within Christianity. And many of it is our own making. We have created so many different churches, and in each different church we have found ways to divide ourselves in terms of community, tribe, caste, culture, and economic strata. In fact, in some churches you have different masses for different economic strata. I mean, it falls into those patterns. So there is a lot that needs to be done for integration. A lot is happening. And we're very hopeful of the way things are going. Also, there is a issue of political backlash against the community. We see a lot of atrocities being committed on an organized scale by entrenched governments in certain states. So this is a huge issue right now. So there are a lot of challenges that we're facing and we're dealing with.
And so, Colin, perhaps a brief reflection and then a similar question posed for a bit more of a dialogue here.
A reflection on the conference itself?
Yes.
Well, it's intriguing, for especially for me, to see a subject such as consumption and justice, especially consumption, to be taken up at a conference, of a church conference, so to speak. And it makes me very pleased, and I'm very happy to see that, because I believe the issue of consumption, like the issue of justice, is it's a behavioral issue. It's a very personal issue. And who is the social custodian of our personal preferences? Who guides us, other than the church? Mm-hmm. This is where we come to get our moral compass reoriented and oiled and cleaned. Mm-hmm. So if it's great to see a church take up this issue and focus the spotlight on this really serious personal issue of consumption and its relation to justice. So I'm very glad to be part of this.
Dr. Perkins, perhaps a reflection on what you've heard Colin mention?
And I'm going to do a more fuller job of this afterward, but we haven't developed, while we have developed great issues of injustice, and this was wonderful, and my sister did some great teaching on the activities of injustice, I don't know whether or not our church now is understanding the depths of justice. that justice was the motivation for all of God's redemption, and that justice is comprehensive, and that you can't understand justice without understanding stewardship, because justice is stewardship. The earth is the Lord and the fullness thereof and all that dwell therein. So justice is comprehensive, it's management, it is how we steward God's resources in the world. And we have isolated justice to one of the big principles, and it is the gospel itself is the good news of the atonement. And that was Jesus' statement at Galilee, the Spirit of the Lord is upon me, for he has anointed me. And the gospel is an announcing of the comprehensiveness of redemption. And so we done made it a single purpose deal. And I think as we go into our discipleship now, I think we are seeing justice return to the church as the throne on which God sat. It was the motivation. It was Paul said, how can he be just and justify you and me? It's all inclusive. And I said more about that this evening.
Amen. Antonio.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned something that I really love, which is stewardship. And the folks who are in my seminar, I mean, they heard some about that. And if we don't understand the stewardship, it's almost worthless to talk about other issues because they are all related to stewardship. And in that sense, I believe we should pay more attention to the theology of creation. Because as evangelicals, we are very good to talk about theology of redemption, and there is no connection to the theology of creation. So it's schizophrenic in one sense, and it doesn't make any sense. So we must bring those two theologies together. But seldom in the church we talk about theology of creation. So we need to regain that theology. And also then go through the Bible and start with the calling of Abraham to be a blessing to all nations. And nations there are is Gentiles, people who are different from us. And then Psalm 67 says about blessings. Why are we blessed? It's because of the other. So stewardship for me is the key to understand the concept of consumption and justice. Mm.
Why do 6% of the world's population need 40% of the oil? Yeah. Right. Why do we need that? Right. Isn't there some form of more equal, creative distribution? And I think that's what my brother from India was talking about. And how do we utilize and how do we equalize that? How do we see the worth and the value and the creative possibility of the poor? Mm-hmm. Not that we're going to patronize the poor, but how do we include them in the creation? Yeah.
Right. Kim, a comment?
I feel like I've said a lot of nice things. I really am preaching to myself because these are issues that we struggle with so much. And like I said, you see, I don't get an audience back home because we don't talk about it. We just, you know, so I come here, oh, great. But I think one issue that does trouble me, and I'd like to address this to Colin, you made that remark this morning that this fellow who came to you, and he turned out to be a crook. Just coming down to something really concrete, how do we know, I mean, do we need to know who the crooks are? How did you know that this fellow was a crook? And, you know, so are we... How do we act justly to people who, you know, might be trying to swindle us or, you know, take us for a ride? Mm-hmm. And I'm sure you've had a lot of experiences in your businesses. So how do you balance those concerns?
Well, maybe I shouldn't have said crook.
That's good.
Well, he had different ideas. He had a different way of doing things. Well, maybe I should just say he was a crook. I'm trying to make excuses for him. There's always going to be people who, for whatever reason, want to take a shorter route to success. who think there is a shorter route to success. And it is these people who, through the ages, have actually contributed to this massive imbalance of resources that God made. See, the Garden of Eden was equal to everyone, you know, until somebody decided that he wanted to own all the apple trees. And he used his intelligence or his position at that point in time to make that happen. Sometimes he used force. So what that fellow was trying to do, and that's why he was a crook, was he was trying to misrepresent the case to me in whatever way to his advantage, using falsehood, using deceit. So when I detect deceit, when I detect falsehood, it's not the straight way. And the definition of a crook is the fellow who doesn't do it the straight way, he does it the crooked way. So it's as simple as that. And how do I deal with him? We don't deal with crooks. We just walk away from him. In business, we are not trying to correct the crook. It's not that I want to, you know, we are not policemen or we are not judges. We just walk away. And I believe there are a lot of decent and straight people in this world to deal with. So it's as simple as that.
Mm-hmm. Antonio, perhaps a reflection and a question to contribute to the dialogue here.
My major issue that I like to talk about and deal about is the role of the people of God in society. And I really believe that the people, these you folks, if you understand the power that God has given to you as his people, you can make a difference. But my fear is that most of the times we don't understand. And we believe that the staff or the pastor or whatever, they are going to do the job. And we are going to look at or to supervise or just, you know, to observe from a distance. And that's not going to happen. Society is going to be transformed only when the people of God understand that they are the salt and the light. You know, and you are actually the pastors, and those whom you're calling pastors are actually your servant, serving you for you to fulfill the mission of God in our society. So when you go out Monday morning, you know, it's amazing. This congregation has about 1,400 members. Just imagine 1,400 people around the city doing God's mission. It's amazing to think like that. But sometimes we don't do it and we don't believe it. So my major issue here is that you understand that it's you. It's you. And God is empowering you to fulfill his mission, to bring justice, to bring transformation into our society.
Please. Yeah, I think the church have lost the lordship of Jesus Christ and that he is the authority within the church. And that's one of our problems. Is that we ask them who are the authority. And the church is supposed to be a call out special, peculiar people, and that Christ is our Lord. And we've lost that lordship. As we lose that lordship, we have lost a prophetic voice. We'll say we got Christians in Congress, but they are who can speak to them. My sheep hear my voice. I know them. Mm-hmm. And that we done lost Jesus being Lord of the church. We're his body. And so I think we've got to work on bringing that community and lordship, and we've got to be identified as unique. We are a royal priesthood. We are a chosen generation. We are a different people. We are to show forth the praise of him who called us out of darkness into this marvelous light. We are to make a creative witness to this world. We have no authority over this world outside of the prophetic voice and the commandment of Jesus to be a witness to society. So they have got to, we got to follow him, and they got to be, we got to reflect him. You know, I think of Gandhi. You know, I've always heard a quote that said that Gandhi said that he would be a Christian if he had seen Christians, and that he says that we should be like the change that we're trying to make in society. Right. We're supposed to reflect that, and that becomes our authority.
Right.
And the church lacking prophetic authority. Yeah.
So let me introduce a question. This is from Dana to Kim. How, if at all, do you encounter issues of justice and consumption in your bioethics work and studies?
I sit on a trans, there's a team of us on the transplant ethics committee, and there's a committee of three persons that every time there has to be an organ transplant, it's got to go through this three-person committee, two medical and one non-medical, and so I'll be that non-medical person. So if an organ transplant would be, say, my kidneys are failing, I need a kidney transplant, my daughter would be a great match, yeah? And she's adult, she's healthy, and, you know, she could donate her kidney. And that works out fine. But sometimes what happens is that I don't want my daughter to donate her kidney because then she's going to suffer for the rest of her life with just one kidney. So I'll look for somebody within my community, say, somebody who's been my gardener. And this has happened. I mean, this is a real case that I'm talking about. Somebody who's been my gardener and, you know, or my gardener's son, who's 24 years old, young, healthy. I say, hey, you know, why don't you help me out here? Issues of, I mean, organ trading, is it just? I don't want my daughter to suffer, but it's fine if I get somebody and get him to donate a kidney. So some of these issues have come up. And so I think it's been a challenge for me as a Christian to speak ethically. And in a way, that's not overtly Christian, because, yeah, I'm a Christian, but I'm in a non-Christian setting, so I can't throw the Bible at them, but I've got to use language and words that are not overtly Christian, but have got that underpinning.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So here's a question that was actually written almost verbatim, the same question twice for Colin. Colin, you ended with a term called the equalization point. What does that mean? And do the others have a sense of how to relate to that? So perhaps you could backtrack to your point of the equalization point.
And was this at the plenary?
Yes, this morning.
Who asked that question? The person is not here? Because I don't really remember what the context of that. Have they quoted anything more than those two words?
Well, let me read the companion question. What did you mean when you said we must all find our equalization or equalizing point? Please elaborate. So you're responding with a please elaborate on the question, it seems.
I'm scrambling to come up with something intelligent here. I think what I meant is a point where we resolve the conflict that we all face in terms of drawing the consumption, and I think it was in relation to the consumption and justice, a point at which we decide what is just consumption for each and every one of us personally. It could be different for every individual. I know it was different for me. I know the point at which I felt this was enough. I developed my own trigger system for that. Mm-hmm. For me, it was all my luxuries. I don't deny myself luxuries. I know I'm a wealthy person. I know I can enjoy luxuries. But at what point do I think that these luxuries reach go beyond what is reasonable? And my trigger point is the sum total of all my luxuries should not exceed 10% of my net worth. That way, I keep it under control. So each one has to develop their own equalization point at which they feel that enough is enough. It could be in relation to yourself. It could be in relation to your community. It could be in relation to the economy that's around you. And especially when you come from a poor country like India, where the contrasts are so evident, so clear, it's very difficult to be able to flaunt your wealth in the face of such excruciating poverty that you see around you. So you have to develop a point at which it makes sense. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So a follow-up question for the rest of the speakers: how would you define a luxury? And how would one define this in their personal life? So, John.
Well, I really feel good about, I'm talking about experimentally. I have felt good about making some kind of determination, and that your life, I have found the quality of my life is better when I make a decision that what is sort of enough for me. Mm-hmm. And I think that have to be reflected within the neighborhood and the community. But there is certain quality of life that comes out better when you take a vow, somewhat of a vow. This is personal, that how much is enough. It seemed that sort of almost gives more freedom. I'm pretty ambitious. I'm pretty driven. And that I see my restraint as mean for me to better love my neighbors as I love myself, mm-hmm. because I've set some kind of standard in my own life. I see that I like that about the priesthood. Yes. I've liked that historically. You know, I'm not approving everything, but historically the Catholic Church has been powerful because it always had a collective stewardship, and the altars and the resources are in the stewardship. Like in our town, we have a wonderful health center there. It's a sister's health center. And I always, and when the health care was being consolidated, rich people were buying them off, big corporations. I talked to the sister and said, please don't sell this because y'all provide the best health care. But they have a collective pool of money out of which they could do that because they have taken a vow of poverty. Mm-hmm. But they are very wealthy, and their wealth is being used to create good health care in my city. So I think taking some form, you know, and of course this is not forced, this should be volunteer. And what makes the church so powerful is that it has the people within the church every Sunday morning with the almost a little excess that you can almost do a lot of things because you have restrained yourself to do that. So I think that it's going to be important that we take some kind of a personal, so there can be a surplus, so there can be, I think that will combat our, I see that working in society. Right. I see that working in the sisters of charity, the different groups that do it, the claims, Claiborne, and people in little communities decide on how they're going to live, and they enrich the whole community.
Right.
I think we do that. I think that has been CCDA's idea, mm-hmm. is that we create some collective so that can be that system there,
right,
to serve the community.
Antonio, comment on luxury and how that might you might reflect on that in your own life.
Well, luxury is, it's very nice. I'm a human being also, you know, I love it. So, but the only minor problem is that I'm a Christian, and if that was not the problem, so it would be great. Luxury for me is when you have, it's not to have, that's not the problem for me. It's when you have and you don't want to share. That's luxury, mm-hmm. Because you know that if you share, it's not going to harm you because you have so much. But the portion that you're going to share is going to help the other, and then you refrain yourself. You are so greed, you want everything for yourself. Mm-hmm. That's luxury. And luxury is also when I have things to show off, you know? Just to make a big demonstration of how much money do I have, and so on and so on. And then we miss the point that we are blessed to bless the other. And so we become the center of the universe in that sense. You know, mm-hmm. I'm God. Because that for me is the problem. I'm God, and I control everything. Instead of listen to the Holy Spirit, and I'm the one who is controlling the resources. Mm-hmm. And that's sinful because ultimately the resources belong to God.
Right. So, Antonio, a follow-up question. How should we balance the biblical call of justice with the biblical principle of joyful freedom and carefreeness? Should we feel guilty about spending money on entertainment? Even Jesus took time to celebrate.
Well, I think the answer is there. The question and the answer is in the statement. Let's celebrate. I'm a big fan of celebration. No, a little beer here and there, it doesn't harm. So, I mean, maybe for you, but I enjoy it. I like to play soccer. I like to go to the movies. I think we should. Actually, we should regain more of the theology of recreation in that sense, you know, mm-hmm. to enjoy more life. And Christians, sometimes they're so uptight. I mean, loosen up a little bit. And okay, I think that's the message of the gospel. It's But then comes Paul. You know, that the problem is the Apostle Paul. No, he's a troublemaker. So, the Apostle Paul is not very friendly sometimes, you know. So don't use your freedom to harm other people. And so we need to have a balance between, you know, the question and the answer.
But there's a strong theme in the Bible of you don't give to get. I don't believe in the so-called prosperity theology. But there is a call for diligence and to work with our own hands so we can have to give to others in need. And that's assumed the idea of this morning in terms of God didn't care about this rich person prospering, but he took his seeds off the market. And then he made it specially for himself. And so God says, I'm going to turn down these buildings and get more buildings, and I'm going to say to my soul, be satisfied. Well, he's depriving. Those seats are going to rot. But he's depriving the market. So God would have been just satisfied with him to reinvest, to put that into the market, and got the return and put the most seats into the market. But he was totally selfish for himself. And that's the definition of sin, my own selfish desire. So give and it shall be given unto you, pressed down, running over. I'm not asking you to be deprived. God is saying in 2 Corinthians, I'm giving, asking you to give out of your abundance and to have that abundance and actually to create an abundance so that there can be, so you're not giving to get, you're giving out of gratitude, but you're creating a collective. That was the whole idea of the tithe system, was to create a collective so there would be people right there in the time of need. So God, this is an important issue, but I have found with my friend and my successful, I've lived 52 years at the total mercy of my friend, and they tell me, I had talked to some today, I haven't deprived them of anything. They think that their participation with me and I with them have enriched our lives together. Those are the practical evidence. I don't even hear a lot of people who say that I was tithing and I went out of business. I don't hear that very much. Mm-hmm. You know, the big message I have is faithfulness. God returned that blessing. He's looking for good stewards right that he can trust.
Right. So next question for you, Colin. How do you screen your loan applicants? You told the story, and you retold it here a little while ago, of the crook who was playing the pastor and tried to play you. How could you tell?
It's not very difficult. There is a process which all banks follow for loan applicants. Banks will generally ask you lots of questions, but they're eventually asking you two things. One is, how are you going to repay this loan? Where's the money going to come from on an ongoing basis? And the second thing they're really asking you with all the different questions they ask you is, for any reason, if you're not able to repay the loan, how do we secure our asset? So what is the collateral? Generally, what you look for when these questions are asked, and they're asked many different ways, is the consistency of the answers. It's very difficult to lie consistently. When somebody lies, there is always an inconsistency of facts, and that those begin to emerge in a pattern. And generally, that's what one looks for. And people tend to fall into traps of their own, especially if they're lying, if they're misrepresenting a fact. And those manifest itself very, very clearly. In terms of determining whether a person is a crook or not, now, inability to repay a loan and therefore not getting a loan for whatever reason, that is one thing. But a malicious intent of misrepresenting a fact for the sole reason of purpose of duping the institution, again, becomes very evident with the background of the person. So there is a detailed background check done, and it's very difficult to cover up your past. Hmm. It's very difficult to come back with and to keep representing new facts in different ways. So these things come out very easily.
Thank you. So here's the next question. I love the concept of trade as one, in parentheses, I just spent $200. But have trouble reconciling the energy it takes to ship the goods with our knowledge to focus on local sustainability, poverty, and justice. Perhaps we can put this for a comment for you all. Antonio, maybe you could start. I know you know where I live. And I have to sleep sometime. But so the notion being, so if we're promoting this appropriate direct trade that involves creating markets in other parts of the world for that require then using transportation for goods to go, you know, from here to there kind of thing. How does that play locally as it relates to sustainability, poverty, and ultimately justice?
I don't know much about that, not this ministry, but the whole concept. I was reading some time ago about it to familiarize with the concept. And one thing that I really hope, and forgive me to say this, but if you don't, that's okay also. It's not another fashion that you Americans are so good to invent. You know, you are very clever to invent new things. And you come up with new names, new ideas, and you call our country some names that we have no idea that you are calling us. We are now the emergent or whatever. I don't know. You have so many names for our nations. I like third world, because that's what we are, you know, losers and poor. And then, so my only fear, and I'm not saying about this one specifically, okay? My only fear is that this one is like a fashion or a trend, and the people down there are not being, they are not being totally, they are not being the recipient of the whole thing. It's just a portion that is really coming to them. And so we end up being like another type of business. And there are so many middle persons in between also from there to here. And so I hope this one and other Christian ministries like that will operate in such a way that the margin for profit will actually go to the people there. Otherwise, we lose the whole perspective of that type of ministry, which is very good. But just a little bit also on that, let us not forget that the usual ministry, like, you know, we had lunchtime, we had the banana, the Chiquita banana, I think that was, from Guatemala. I don't know if you noticed it. It's from Guatemala. A lot of people were working for those companies, and they need to work for those companies in order to make a salary to take food home. So in one sense, we have to do in such a way that we cannot destroy the other business as well, because they also need, the workers need. You may not like the Chiquita, whatever company it is, you know, you may have issues with that company, but the people who are working there, they need to work, and those companies are providing jobs for them. So it's important as well, so we don't get rid of those companies. You know what I mean? So let's do this one, but not ostracize the other one so much that the companies will shut down in Latin America and suddenly people don't have a job anymore. So, and of course, there are many, many issues involved. People are raising crops in Latin America, but then the companies here are imposing the price, and the price is so low, but they have to sell because the companies here are imposing them. And somehow they will say, I'm not going to raise bananas anymore. I'm going to raise some drugs. And then you complain, oh, why are you changing from banana to that green thing? You know, because they make more money. But they were raising bananas before, but you were paying so little, and now you're complaining that the people are raising some other thing. So it's very complex in one sense. That's what I'm trying to say.
Yeah, so what you're really framing is sort of the supply and demand of economics. Colin, you have a comment?
Trade is one, and the whole fair trade movement has one very important distinction from... let's say Walmart, for that matter. They're sourced from all over the world also. The difference is the transparency and the opaqueness in the way they do it. The Walmart system is very opaque. You really don't know how and where that item has been manufactured and in what way. There is no social audit trail. There's only, at best, a financial audit trail, which, again, you don't see. What Traders One and such organizations try to provide to you is a social audit trail. Many of these products that you saw at the Traders One store are made not in a factory or setting, but more in a personal, like the jewelry and the other small items. They're made in home-based industry. So the percentage of what you pay that goes into the hands of the person who's actually making it is far higher than in a mechanized setup. So these two aspects have to be kept in mind. Somebody made a comment earlier to me in my seminar about how does it make sense to me if I'm going to be paying 25 or 30% more for something which I can buy on the high street, cheaper, of equal quality? The answer is, you're right. It doesn't make sense today. But this fair trade movement and this trade, like Traders One, will grow. It will grow in scale. And when it grows in scale, the margins will come down, and the price gap between high street and the fair trade will narrow down. Fair trade is one of the fastest growing retail industries in the world today. And this thing will narrow down to the point where you will be able to buy quality at a reasonable price and make a difference all at the same time.
But I for my side, I would like to see or to learn how much more they are getting. Not just come in and say, we are paying more for the producers. My question is, how much more? I would like to know before I make a purchase, because I really don't mind buying something for $100 from the fair trade organizations instead of paying $70 to another guy. I don't mind paying $100, but I would like to know how much of those eventually will get to the hands of those people down there. Okay, their lives are really being transformed, because everywhere you go here in U.S., you go to this one body or whatever body shop. It has some pictures of Brazil there. We are buying things for Brazilian whatever. I had no idea about that. Is that marketing? It's make believe, or are they really paying something extra to the Brazilians there? How do we know? So that's my question, and if this is a Christian organization, I think we should inform the people, and the people are gonna be happy to buy. And I believe he's right in that sense. No, we are gonna buy, and even pay more, because we know the money is really going there. But if I don't know, I'll have some suspicions because I'm a Brazilian.
So it's issues of transparency.
Transparency
and
that he mentioned, it's very important.
If I may make a point. You're absolutely right, Antonio. And the whole fair trade market is nascent. It's growing and developing. And maybe the missing link here is a certification agency, or probably a quality mark that assures you a certain level of audit, or certain level of audit trail, and guarantees that a certain percentage, a minimum of certain percentage of what you pay, goes into the hands of the producer.
That's
you've just given me a business idea. Thank you.
There we go. John, you wanted to make a comment?
I think we have to look at added value, as I do, and I think the information, informing the public. I do a lot in the Northwest, and I find that many of the Northwest companies are very successful. They play living wage, and they are also concerned about the quality of life of the companies that they export from. And it and so I don't buy nothing but a roll from Starbucks because the coffee is very high. But I really appreciate them in the sense of their thoughtfulness. And I think a lot of that is in us. And so people don't mind paying a little bit more because they got confidence. And so in the Northwest, you don't have sweatshops. Costco is different from Walmart. Boeing pays a fair wage. And the quality of life of the people who work there feels better. So I think that we have to, and I like what I hear the president of Starbucks, where he talks about how is the people living mm-hmm. in the country in which he exports his coffee from.
Right.
Is they getting a chance of education? I think these are important things in terms of fair trade. Yeah.
So,
So I think we do have something, a quality, and we should praise those, the Bible says, that do good, you know, for the society. And so we should push eco-trade. God has placed people in the bounds of their natives so they can make a somewhat of an eco-exchange, and it's not fair for us then to rip those off without making a contribution. But I think there are business people who think that way. I do a lot with business people. And some of those business people think that way, and that they're seeing the bottom line working pretty good for them who do that. And I think we as a Christian body can see that, and that we can then act as a collective whole.
So let's open the discussion to, as exemplified by the neighbors here, to the university community. What would you say to a college student who's ready to graduate and enter the workforce and start playing the game, in quotation marks? I'll interpret. So playing the game, entering the workforce, as we heard Nathan George last night describe his pursuit of wealth and climbing the slippery or the greased pole, as it were. So young people, perhaps even carrying debt, entering the workforce.
Can I?
Your advice.
Exactly what I told my son who graduated in December. Lucky you. I wish it was me. I wish I was 22 years old and just graduated and starting all over again. What a great place to be.
And personal, that's what, as I'm finishing up my life and I'm sensing I'm getting a pretty good hearing, is calling these young folks to a high value of life and challenging them in terms of this values of using their skills and discovering the skills and giving that skill back to God. I feel that there's a rising, I think there went this period of, you go back 10 years ago, people wanted their children to get on that ladder. I feel that there are young folks asking that question themselves now. But I think they got to be loved by the church and embraced. And so I see this is part of my, that's why I'm here.
Right.
And to encourage those people to find values that are better and deeper and more precious just getting on that ladder of that treadmill.
So, Dr. Perkins, here's a question addressed to you. It's fairly lengthy. I'll read it. I'm a teacher of inner city youth whose families deal with poverty, immigration issues, and high crime in their neighborhoods. How can I and other educators continue to proclaim the hope of Jesus Christ and our passion for justice in the midst of discouragement and sadness as we see some of our students get pulled into gangs, get killed at a young age, or are victims of brutal violence. How do we help them see the importance of education in the midst of all they face?
If I knew the answer to all that, I wouldn't be here. You are asking one of the most comprehensive questions, because the issue there is a broken family. And I don't think that people understand, even as we heard the statistic, that 90% of the young people that go to prison come from homes where there's no father. You go out to all these statistics, so this is a heavy deal, creating family, and the church being family, you know, and moving into these communities, and creating a quality of life for that small community, and begin to do the kind of a tutoring within those neighborhoods. But I don't think there's not much of a national solution to that anymore. I think that our society so undermines the morals and the fabric of the family by law, mm-hmm. that the church will have to do this. And this is one of my pushes now, is that for the big mega church, and I think folks are ready for it, is to plant churches in these very frail communities and call out 25 people, young people, with skills to relocate and to live and to take their skills and make their skills worthwhile, mm-hmm. in those neighborhoods. I don't see any other way, because we've been operating on the idea that we was rich enough to do all that without those people participating that much in it, right. because we looked at ourselves as the rich people. But more or less now that we got to bring the skills and the values and create community where that those kids then will have a substitute father, a substitute mother, and have coaches within those communities. But we got to do it right there in that neighborhood.
Right. So Mark submits the following question. What is the relationship in a global sense between overconsumption and poverty? Is it possible to fight poverty successfully without reducing the standard of living of the top 10% economically? And if not, shouldn't we be saying it clearly?
Okay. I'm of the opinion that I don't believe that you need to reduce or lower the standard of living of the richest people to contribute to the poor. I am not a great fan of robbing Peter to pay Paul. You see, consumption, and in some cases overconsumption, has its value. It has a value, like I said earlier, for the producer. Now, the overconsumption damages the consumer more than the producer. So if America is overconsuming, it's causing damage to the American, not to the Chinese manufacturer or the Indian manufacturer, believe me. So that's not the solution. In fact, if the top 10% or 20% stop consuming or consume much less, it could cause more damage to the poorer countries. So that's not the answer. The answer is probably a better investment of the resources of the top 10%. Mm-hmm. Just a slight change in attitude, a slight change, to put more of their resources where it will have a stronger social impact without mm-hmm. compromising on financial return. Mm-hmm. And I believe that is possible.
Suggest you go to a website called poverty.com, and there are simple things that over there that you can do, and it's very self-instructive. And as a Christian, I think we should do more. I mean, be more vocal toward our politicians and the leadership of our cities and so on. So, how many people in this congregation here are involved in the making decisions of this city? And that's what I'm saying. You know, if we as a people of God, we don't take it into our hands, we are going to be complaining this over here and next conference and next and next. So as you go home, just ask yourself, you know, what can I do? We are not telling you to save the planet. Let Jesus do it. No, he knows how to do it. You know, sometimes we are so strange. If we cannot save the whole planet, I'm not going to do anything. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, so get rid of that mentality. Do a small thing. And if you do a very small one, the other one also, and so, and so, and so. And then we get together and we make the community working together. And so that's, for me, is the key. It's the community working together. But let me say this. My fear in this conference is that you go home, and tomorrow is Sunday. I believe you have to come over here because you are a good Christian. But Monday, you are gone. And there will be other news, other things, other issues. And you're going to forget the things that you heard here. It's very likely that you're going to forget. Unless you go home this weekend, this very weekend, and you get down into your knees, and you pray to God, and you say, God, I am not a Mickey Mouse. I am your creation. I'm your instrument, and I can do something. Please help me. Empower me. And then God's going to lead you. The other question was about the young people getting to the market. It saddens my heart that the young people in our church, by and large, they don't have a passion for Jesus anymore. They are so preoccupied making their careers or making money that Jesus is like a fable. I mean, it's just an image. And I would like to see young people in our church being very bold for Jesus, creating new things for Jesus. Like, you know, when you're very young and you started your ministry. Where are the young people today in our church? No, create something, folks. Get rid of the liturgy. Do a blog for Jesus, whatever, you know, create a blog for this conference, ask people to get into the blog, do something. It's very possible. Today we can do a lot of things. The internet's there to help us. So I would say if you are open to the Holy Spirit in this conference, go home, go to your room, get down to your knees, ask the Holy Spirit to give you an idea. And you can say, God, I don't know how to do much, but this is what I'm willing to do. Remember the woman that broke that perfume on Jesus' head? What did he say about her in English? I know in Portuguese. She has done what? A good thing for me. Don't bother her. You see, go home, and if you can only break a little perfume on Jesus' head, 2,000 years from now, people are going to talk about you. Isn't that amazing? We are talking about that woman that we don't even know her name or whatever. No, there are many names there, but today we are fulfilling what Jesus said. People are going to talk about her because she only broke a little perfume on his head. So, isn't that amazing? So, go home. Where is your little perfume? Present that to Jesus. It's huge. Don't let the devil tell you that you cannot do it. But this is his job, and he's a good devil to do it. You know, he does it very well. So go home, get down to your knees and say, Jesus, I have this little perfume. I'm going to break it into your head. And 2,000 years from now, people are going to talk about me. Do you have that guts? I hope you do. So don't look at yourself saying, I'm nothing. If you are nothing, Jesus, you know, has done wrong dying on the cross for you. He died on the cross for you because you are his new creation. So that's what we need to regain, folks. But I'm preaching, sorry.
Okay, so. And so it's my sad responsibility to note that time has flown.
Yes.
And we've gotten through only a small number of the questions that were submitted. Our apologies for not getting to your particular question if you had submitted it. Antonio gets more time to speak. Dr. Perkins gets more time to speak. But I would like to offer thanks on behalf of the conference attendees for your generous offer of your time and your insights. So thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, we're going to take just a really quick stretch break, and then we're going to hear from Dr. Perkins, and that will be the last moment in our conference. Dr. Perkins will be speaking tomorrow night at the 505, as well, and Antonio Barra will be in our morning 3 services. So let's take just a couple of minutes to stretch, and then we'll call us back together with a song, and we'll hear from Dr. Perkins.
Some of you are already standing. We invite the rest of you to stand with us and sing together. Someone back there turn the slides on, please.
Sing that first verse again. Be thou my
vision. Let's stand together.
Thank you.
want to introduce Nellie Stanell. She's been really the person that you've probably gotten emails for. And I just want to say thank you for all her work on the Global Church Conference.